Good morning, everybody, and a big welcome to the Buddhist Society. I know there are many people from all over the world, and from England and Australia and various places. So a very, very big welcome. And just to say that this is the highlight of this part of the year for us, because Ajahn Brahm is usually with us in person, but he can't be with us now, so he's online all the way from New South Wales. So it's a real delight. Those of you who don't know Ajahn Brahm, he was trained in the forest tradition of northern Thailand in Wat Pa Pong, which was a temple where Ajahn Chah, a famous and great teacher, was, and studied under him for many years, and trained under him for many years. And it's a real, real treat to have him with us today and talking to us. The title of today's talk is Opening the Lotus. But before we get to that, I want to advertise his book, Opening the Heart. Now, this is a lovely book, and I've been reading it with great amusement and happiness, I must say. Many of the stories I've read before, but they're said in such a way and told in such a way that they are a real delight, honestly, a real delight. And I would encourage you all, you know, as a little book to dip into, to brighten and lighten your day. When we can't see Ajahn Brahm anymore, we'll have this book and we can open it and read one of the little stories. They really are a great pleasure to read. So get it. The book is actually normally only available from Kandy, but we're going here at the Society, we're going to get copies in. So those of you who would like to buy a copy, I don't know the price yet, but it's in rupees here, but we won't be adding much to it except for the basics. And so please do write to us and we'll be able to send you a copy. We'll let you know what it's going to cost and so on. But without more ado, I'll hand you over to the speaker. But if you've got questions, you'll see a chat bar down at the bottom of your screen. And you write your questions in there. And at the end of the talk, we can then read them out and they'll be dealt with. So thank you very much indeed.
Very good. Dealt with politely. Very good. So it's great to see you all again. And I'm sorry I can't be there personally, but over here in Western Australia, things are going very, very well. We can travel around a lot now. I was very joyfully seeing that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. And one thing which I haven't told you is actually how that book actually began. It's my first book which I ever wrote. And it was so easy. It's literally that what happened was all these stories which I've told in many, many places, and many of you have heard live, that all those stories, they were really helpful for people. And there was one person in particular, very unfortunate, that their husband was, please excuse me, sexually abusing her children. And when she found out about it, you know, it was a very, very big problem and crisis for her. She managed to get over that, you know, with the help of, you know, people like myself. And then afterwards, she said, all those stories you told me during that time, they really helped me. They even actually stopped me committing suicide. And she said, you must, Ajahn Brahm, please write them down in a book so they can be shared widely. And I thought, well, you know, I'm a bit of a lazy monk. I said, I can't do that. I'm too busy. So she said, okay, I will write them down and I'll send them to you to edit before it gets printed. And so she wrote down those stories. And my goodness, she was such a smart lady. She totally picked me, because she made such a terrible job of writing the stories. I thought, I can't let people write the stories like that. I'll have to do them. So in the end, I decided, okay, I'm going to write the book. But the amazing thing is, and this is not an exaggeration, totally true, that now I was having a little retreat, and I thought, I'll just spend maybe an hour every day for 15 days, just an hour in the afternoon, just writing down the stories one by one. And I wrote them down, and it took me just 1 hour every day for 15 days, and half the book was completed. And because I was meditating, and I was very peaceful and very still, You wrote them down and there was just no mistakes. And even just, there's no, not even any type, well, I wasn't typing, I wrote them down by hand. No, not even any sort of typographical efforts. I didn't need to correct anything. It was just, came just coming out smoothly, perfectly. And it really shocked me just how easy it was to write. I waited a few weeks and then took another couple of weeks to write the other half, the second half. So it took me just about 30 hours to write that book. But then, of course, once you wrote it, I got somebody of mine to actually to type it all out. And on one of those OCDs. And I was going to Melbourne to give a series of talks. He just gave it to me just as I was going to the airport to catch the flight from Perth to Melbourne. And when I arrived in Melbourne, the first talk was at the University of Melbourne. And I went in there just almost straight from the airport to the university, gave a talk. And then after the talk, this lady came up to me. I kind of never forget her name. And it was, actually, I forgot her name now. It was, I'll remember it in a moment. I think it's in the front of the book anyway. I say I can't remember her name, but I have the excuse here. It's very hot in West Australia this evening. It's over 30 degrees. So, you know, this brain was made in England. So it sometimes doesn't work at full capacity at this type of temperature. But anyway, she said afterwards, she said, oh, it was a wonderful talk you gave. If ever you have a book you want to write, please let me see it first of all, because she worked for a publishing company. And all I did was reach into my bag and gave her the CD, said, here it is. I never even needed to send it to a publisher. I never needed him to look for a publishing house. It just went there and just got published. And then that's why her name was Magnolia Flora. A really sort of very flowery name. But she published the book and it, you know, it's done incredibly well in many parts of the world. But you know, sometimes when something is meant to happen, it happens just so easily. Sometimes karma or whatever it is. But nevertheless, one of the things I did realize is that when you wrote this down during a meditation retreat, a personal retreat, it was so easy. There's no effort at all. Just write it and no mistakes. The mind was almost like perfect. And so that really reminded me of just how wonderful it is to develop the mind in things like meditation during one's life, no matter what one does, if one is an author, if one is a banker, if one is the president of the Buddhist Society in London, whatever you're doing. That having a bit of meditation makes life so much easier. But, of course, you know, just how do we do that meditation? One of the most common questions which people ask me, and they say, well, we know that meditation is all about learning how to let go. But how do you let go? Now, jump on, please help me know. How do you let go? And this is one of the reasons why I used an old simile in Buddhism about the thousand petal lotus and opening up that lotus. It's a wonderful simile, which is how you let go and what happens afterwards. Because even saying let go is a bit sort of, if you don't mind, a bit negative. In the sense you've got to let go of something. Yeah, you let go of something, but you also, what's left, you let be. So when you let go, you're letting go of controlling, doing things, wanting something for the future, being upset at what happened in the past. That's what you let go of. And what's left, that you let be. You don't try and get rid of anything right now. You stop all this wanting, this willing, this judgment, and just let this moment be and see what happens. And a beautiful idea of letting things happen, being so passive. And what happens is not just sloth and torpor or sleepiness or dullness. It is the mind wakes up. It's one thing which you may know from your mobile phones or even your tablets, if you have, I'm talking about all the tablets you eat when you're sick. You know, the little tablets you carry around with you, which actually often make you sick, those other tablets. And those, whatever you sort of carry around with you, sometimes it runs out of energy. it was a mobile phone, you can't get a good signal because I always remember the mobile phones, they're really weird. They used to call them cell phones. Isn't that trying to tell you something, a cell phone? It's a prison. And that's why the people they look upon see how many bars they've got on their cell phones. You know, which is, they tell me that's, no, I actually don't have a cell phone. I don't have an iPhone or any mobile phone. But they tell me that the more bars you have, the better connection you have. I think, is that really true? Can't you look at it another way? The more bars you have on your cell, the more imprisoned you are. So I like to look at things in a different way. But anyway, that the more you use that phone, the more you tire out. And it needs to be re-energized. And that's what actually happens when a person does their meditation, you know, learning how to, as I was reminded this evening, to relax to the max, to re-energize yourself. When you re-energize your mindfulness, the mindfulness gets really strong. And what happens is amazing. It's called the path of meditation. Really re-energizing your mind and seeing what happens. So I use the simile of the lotus to give a way of describing the process of opening this mind. I'm sure that you have heard a simile before because I've given it so many times. I invented this particular interpretation of the simile and I've used it very commonly. But even so, you'll probably always find every time you retell a story or you tell a simile, you always add a little bit here, take a little bit off there. It's always somehow different. And if you really understood the simile, you'd be able to open your own lotus and experience all these incredible things which happen. So anyway, the thousand-petaled lotus, how it works. You've all seen lotuses. It's one of the great symbols of Buddhism throughout the world. And the Buddha used the lotus in many other ways. One of the other ways which he used the symbol of the lotus was one I often teach also, is that a lotus has this incredible, I'm not quite sure what it is botanically or chemically, surface on every petal, that when water drops on it, the lotus doesn't get wetted by the water. Everything just runs off it. That's often been a lovely simile, that when people just criticize you or praise you, let that praise and blame, that criticism and praise, let it all sort of drip off. Let it all fall off so nothing really affects you. And the simile, to make it nice and easy to understand, if somebody, they're urinating on a lotus and they urinate all over the lotus, all that urine just falls off. And afterwards, if you smell that lotus, it smells of lotus. It's fragrant because no urine remains on the lotus petals. And then if somebody else comes along and they pour Chanel number 5 all over the lotus, then all that perfume just falls off it. And the lotus retains none of that perfume. And you pick it up afterwards and it smells like a lotus. And that's, you know, when people praise you. You can receive that praise, but none of it sticks. It all flows off. And all the urine just flows off. So all you ever keep is this beautiful fragrance of a person who's not affected by praise. A person who's not affected by criticism. The beautiful, perfect smell and fragrance of a lotus. So if anyone is praising you or blaming you in your life, please remember, you say, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a lotus. So you can receive it, but nothing sticks. Well, the main part of the lotus simile is that you all know that a lotus closes up at night time. It only opens up when the sun comes up in the early morning. It's one of the reasons why you don't see so many lotuses in London, because at this time of the year, so the sun never comes up, it seems. If it is the dawn or sunrise, it's too much clouds in the sky. But, sort of in Asia especially, there's many, many clear mornings. And when the first rays of the sun, they meet the outermost sheath of the lotus flower, the lotus receives the warmth and the light and starts to open. It opens automatically. And once the outermost sheath has opened, then the first real layer of petals can receive the warmth and the light of the morning sun. And that too starts to open, allowing the light from the sun and its warmth to warm up the second layer of petals. And every layer of petals opens up one after the other, allowing the next layer of petals to receive the warmth and light of the sun. And that's how the lotus opens up layer by layer until you get right deep inside that lotus. And the other thing about the lotus flower is the deeper you go into that lotus, the more beautiful, the more delicate, the more profound, if you like, are those petals. And the more beautiful and fragrant they are as you go closer and closer to the center of the lotus. Now that's a simile which I think everybody's either seen or can relate to. What has that to do with meditation, with Buddhism? And of course the answer is that, you know, you are that lotus. Your body and mind are the lotus flower. And that's one of the reasons why people sometimes look at themselves in today's world and they think they're hopeless, they're terrible. They think, I can't meditate. Many people say, well, you know, you're a monk, maybe you were born, you know, with special abilities to meditate, I can't do it. I said, I don't agree with that at all. If you manage to find how to do the meditation, everyone can meditate. They can. Maybe they might not do it, they won't do it, but their ability is there. As long as they have decent instructions, they don't complicate things too much. So, how do you open up this lotus? You look at the outermost sheath. You think it's hopeless, it's terrible. And at this time, when I teach retreats, and some of you have heard me teach retreats, I tell this anecdote. When I was teaching a 9-day retreat in our retreat center, which is just opposite our monastery here in Western Australia. And I was just hanging around welcoming people at the reception desk. And this gentleman came up. He was very tall, you know, Australian, Caucasian, had tattoos all over him, and he was wearing Australian national dress, which meant a pair of thongs, shorts, and a sort of a t-shirt. And that's all. He may be young in his maybe early 30s. And I'd never seen him before. And I admit to many people that sometimes I make stupid mistakes, and this was one of them. I judged him straight away. I never expected to see a person like that with so many tattoos all over him and just badly dressed coming into our retreat center. And we do actually have, just not too far away from the retreat center, only 6 kilometers down the road, a prison farm. And so I told him straight away, sir, I think you've got the wrong place. The prison is up the road, about 6 kilometers. If you want to meet your friends, they're over there. And he said, no, I'm on this retreat. I booked in and I checked his name. He was on it. I said, I apologize to him. I said, I judge you. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that. But I admitted it. And so he joined our retreat. He was the one I least expected to get some really fantastic meditations. But then when he came in for an interview one day, he started describing what he'd experienced, and he'd opened up his lotus really deeply. And I said, sir, that, you know, that was a jhana you experienced, a real one. Not one of these fake ones which go around these days, but a real one. Well done. And after he left, it really, as they say, blew me away. I never thought that that person could go so deep. So the outermost sheath of that lotus flower gives no indication of what's inside. So how do you open up those sheaths of lotuses, your body and mind? As I mentioned, it's a warmth from the light of the sun. And in this simile, the light of the sun stands for mindfulness, your awareness. And the warmth is the kindness, the compassion, which I don't know why, but too many people forget when they're meditating. Kindness, compassion is one of the central parts of Buddhism. When I was a student, it was one of the things which really attracted me to this Buddhist path. That, you know, just not following rules was not as important as being kind, compassionate. And to this day, you know, we have our monastic rules here in Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth, where I live, where I'm the boss. And the first rule in the list of monastic rules for the local rules for the monks here is to be compassionate. It's more important than respect or, you know, doing it this way and doing it that way. Please be compassionate, because that's so important. So, and that's what we do when we are looking at that lotus, our body and mind. We're looking at our body and mind just with those two things, with awareness together with this kindness. And if ever any of you have either been on one of my guided meditation retreats, or try to meditate yourself, you've seen me many times, or heard me many times, say, just close your eyes, be aware of your body, and be kind to your body, really kind to it. So, you know, you relax your legs, you relax your bottom, you relax your back, your chest, everything. Your shoulders, your arms, and your face, everything. And after a while, when you develop enough awareness and kindness, to relax again to the max, you find that just those two things, awareness and kindness, they become very, very strong. And you find your body does become so much at ease. And this is the way I relax. You know, sometimes you've had a busy day or you've drunk too much tea. I'm not a coffee monk, but I still, you know, carry on those genetic inclination towards cups of tea, and so that I sometimes take too much tea, and so sometimes it's difficult to fall asleep at night. So what do? I just lay down there and just relax my body really a lot with lots of kindness. If it falls asleep, fine. If it doesn't fall asleep, fine. But I'm going to relax very, very deeply. And when I do that, I actually never finish just, you know, the sweep of the body. I just wake up in the morning. I've just had a good night's sleep. Just learning how to be kind and aware. And also, many times there's sicknesses in the body, like whether it's colds. I remember so many times, it's amazing. Sometimes you have this terrible cold. I remember this was in South Korea once, when I was about to go on the national TV there to give a talk, an interview or something, I forget what, but it was national TV. And oh, I was sneezing. It was really, really cold where I was staying. And snot was coming out of my mouth, out of my nose. My eyes were watering and I felt really terrible. And I had half an hour before I was going to go on live TV. But unfortunately, I just know what to do. You just had half an hour of meditating, closing your eyes, being so kind to my own face and my sinuses, where the problem was coming from. So incredibly kind and aware, not trying to get anything, not trying to let go of something, but letting it be. Being kind and being aware. Because being kind is not trying to get rid of things. Being kind is letting things be without judging, without discriminating, not stigmatizing a cold or anything, just totally opening the door of your heart to those feelings. When you did that, it only took half an hour and the cold was gone. I mean, really gone, not suppressed, not taking any medication, but just wasn't there anymore. And it's amazing just what can happen. I'm not exaggerating, I've done that many times. It's beautiful what you can do with mindfulness and kindness. Your whole body just relaxes and gets well and healthy. And then, once it's not causing any problem or business because it's not demanding attention anymore, it feels really at ease. And then, It vanishes, it disappears. The outermost sheath of the lotus opens up, just for mindfulness and kindness. And inside you get the first layer of petals. This is your mind, your emotional world. And with that emotional world, you know, the first thing which, you know, which comes up is this terrible thing called time. The past and the future. Where, if you have a past, well, we carry it around too much, too heavily. And the future, it became quite clear to me years ago that your future is being made right now. Now is the only time you can do anything for your future. So if you really care about your future, care more about the present moment. So by being mindful and being kind, you find the past and the future start to vanish. This is something which many people, you know, they don't emphasize enough. How do you let go of the past and how do you stop worrying about the future? Especially, you know, in times like COVID and, you know, other times when you may have a cancer or all sorts of other things going wrong. Going wrong, that's the wrong word anyway. I said wrong twice. And being sick is part of life. Things not going the way you want to is, again, part of life. But, you know, when these things sort of happen, how do we let go of our fear of the future and the fear of the past? We don't try to let them go. We let them be. With kindness, opening the door of your heart to your past. Open the door of your heart to your future. Giving it mindfulness and kindness. It sounds counterintuitive, but this is actually what happens. If you have ill will towards the past, you reinforce it. If you have fear to the future, it really bugs you a lot. If you're kind to the past and the future, really give it heaps and heaps of compassion. You finally get so soft, so peaceful, just like your body, and it just disappears by itself. That's one of the great ways. Don't have ill will, negativity towards past and future, your past and future. Your past is there, it's happened. So just be kind to it. Give it a nice, well, I didn't do the right thing, you know, calling that sort of, thinking that guy with tattoos was visiting his prison mates. And he was a meditator. I forgave myself. I was kind to that past. And I make use of it in my stories and tales of all the failures I've done in my life, laughing at myself. I make use of it. I'm kind to it. And I'm kind to the future as well. You know, that I'm positive towards the future. Always am. I'll probably see you over in the Buddhist Society in London in Eccleston Square sometime next year. I'm sure I'm probably earlier than we imagine. But anyway, we'll wait and see that. But I'm pretty positive this is going to happen. So by being kind to the future and kind to the past, it doesn't bug you anymore. It doesn't obsess you. It's not a big problem. So even the past and the future can disappear. And you come into this beautiful moment called now. And this is where you open up this other layer of petals, of time. You come into the now, right here. This is where you are. This is our life. It happens now. This is the real stuff happening now. And as you come into this layer of petals called, you know, now, time petals have just vanished. The next layer of petals which you come up with is all these descriptions and all these words, all the stuff which I write in books and all the stuff which I talk about in talks. I think you all know, you've seen me many times at in Eccleston Square. You've seen me, I never have notes. I never decide to read a script out. It always just comes out when I just trust my mind and just let things be and see what comes out. So this is what's happening right now. And so that you stop thinking. You stop trying to judge yourself or give things names. So often in our world, why do we think? Why do we try and capture reality with imperfect descriptions by words? You can't describe the sunset. You can't even just describe the sound of the first birds which come out in the springtime. Poets can get very close. Even poets, they only get sort of maybe 50% close to the reality. And the real truth is only comes from silence. When you can trust this moment, trust is important, that you can just hear and listen in silence. You don't need to say anything. You don't need to try and capture anything. Your mind is very sharp. It does remember things. You don't need to try and remember things. Certainly you don't need to take notes during a talk like this. Fortunately, in today's world, everything is recorded, so you can always get a recording afterwards if you think you missed anything. But right now, you can just get into the experience of what's happening. With no thoughts, no comments, no judgments, just enjoying it. And you find, naturally, you don't do anything. The lotus petal of thinking opens up. And you're in the silent awareness of now. At first, people get afraid of these inner petals of the lotus because many people aren't used to them. It's almost as if I don't think, I'm not there, or someone's going to take advantage of me. You're afraid. Your security is down. But after a while, you get these three stages in every new experience in meditation. I call them three stages because it makes people feel good about each stage. The first one is recognition. You understand what I'm talking about. What is like silence? You've been there, you know it. Number two is familiarity. You recognize that you've been there enough times. You feel like, oh, it's just silence. You know what it is. And the last is like you feel at ease there, like you're at home there. So you don't need to disturb it or worry that it's going to be disturbed or taken away. You've been in the silence so many times. It's like a second home to you. And it's like just, oh, I'm back home. I can enjoy myself. It's one of the similes Ajahn Chah used to use, our real home. What is your real home? It may not be the little cottage you stay in or the apartment you live in, or for me, the little cave I live in. That's not your real home. Your real home is the silence inside your heart. And even deeper than that. But nevertheless, after a while, we feel at home there. And it's important to have that feeling of being at home in every stage of meditation, because that's where one can truly relax. So one doesn't disturb the home you've got into. You feel at ease there. And that means you can stay there a long time. So you're in the silence. Then what happens? Then you don't do anything. Then that wonderful layer of petals, just the silent awareness in the present moment. And then what happens? It's weird, but this always happens to me, and I think to almost everybody else. Most people become aware of their breathing. Why? And the answer is because this is still moving. It's one of the last things which are moving. Your body is pretty still, but that's still going on. Nothing else is disturbing you, so that's almost one of the last bodily movements which is there. And you don't go looking for it. You don't try and get it. It just happens, naturally. Which means that it's just such a relaxing, easy process when you don't get in the way to disturb it. You're just being mindful and being kind in this moment, in the silence. And then the petal opens up, the layer of petals called being aware of the breath. Now, of course, you remember now that you're not doing very much. So because your brain is not active, you don't need much breath. Your body is pretty still. That doesn't need much breath. So the breath is very light and smooth. Very easy to watch, because it is delightful. Anything which is very refined and your mindfulness is up to the has been energized enough to be able to see this, it gives it so much kindness, because that's your nature. Compassion and awareness on your breath. And you start to see much more of your breath. From the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. The full awareness of the breath. Another layer of petals opens up. Not just aware of the breath anymore, the full awareness. There's so many experiences just for one in-breath. So many experiences for one out-breath. You really get into this. And even like, you know, the perception of time is just really weird. Because, you know, so one breath, in-breath takes almost, you don't really count seconds or whatever, but you see so much of it. And it's just fascinating. It's just no exaggeration. You see that just every in-breath is totally unique. In all my life, I've never breathed two in-breaths the same. Which is weird, but it's true. So they're unique. Beautiful. The deeper you go into the lotus, the more fragrant, profound, and beautiful are the petals. And just still with the breath. And that opens up to what we call the delightful breath. The piti sukha, the joy and happiness with the breath. This is those stages of anapanasati, as the Buddha taught. Where you're breathing in and out, experiencing piti, sukha, just wow. And this is not just small amounts of happiness. It is quite large amounts of happiness. To the point that many, many people sit for hours. I often mention that they miss their lunch. They're on a retreat. Even though they're on 8 precepts and they can't eat anything in the evening, they don't care. It's much more important to just have this beautiful experience of meditation. Those innermost petals of your lotus are so delightful, you don't want to move away from them. And no effort at all. No more effort than to listen to a beautiful concert. I remember this sometimes, just as a student in Cambridge, sometimes walking, going somewhere else and just passing by a hall and somebody was playing some beautiful music. And I just had to stop and listen. I had to, because you know, I wasn't trying. It just drew me in. This beautiful music from Monteverdi was one of my favorites. And just, it drew me in. I just couldn't go anywhere. I had to stop. It's like the beauty of even like the breathing. It gets delightful. So of course you're still. You've got no sort of restlessness or no movement of the mind. The mind doesn't wander anywhere. It's just being delighted just by your own breath. Weird, isn't it? But it's true. You're going into your lotus. And the deeper you go, the more amazing are those petals. And you go deeper. The delight just gets stronger and stronger. And the delight gets so strong, we go into what we call the nimittas. Usually described as beautiful lights which appear in the mind at this stage of meditation. And these are not uncommon. So you're sitting there just so delighted in what you're experiencing. The delight just takes over, much more stronger than the breath. The breath petals just all open up. And when they open up, you go deeper into these nimittas. You see the beautiful colours in the mind, and one of the signs that this you go into this state of mind is you can hardly feel your body or feel a body at all. That's opened up as an outer petal. And in a moment, no thinking, just enjoying to the max. And even the breath you can't be aware of. It's just in the background. What you're aware of is just beautiful joy and delight. And these wonderful nimittas. And sometimes afterwards you perceive them. Say afterwards, because at the time you don't take notes. Remember perfectly everything which happened. And they appear like lights in the mind. The more simple, the more pure, bright those lights are, the better. And a little trick of the trade, not a trick of the trade, but a little sign, these are your nimittas. They shock you at first, because you say you see a blue nimitta. And it's more blue than any blue you've ever seen in the world. It's like blue and then just taken to the next level of blueness. were like yellow, but golden yellow. Almost, you can't see golds like that in the world. But these are real. You're not going crazy. You're just glissing out. Because the joy and happiness is very strong. And of course that takes you into the next layer of petals. Nimittas open up. You don't do anything. You don't go anywhere else. You go inside where you are already. And inside that nimitta land, you shall find the first jhana. And there, the body is so distant, you can't feel it. And the mind is so still that no thinking, missing out on this incredible layer of petals. So profound, so fragrant, as it happens. And what do? Nothing. Just your awareness is incredibly strong. And your kindness is there as well. It was there in the beginning, it's really strong now. You don't change anything, you don't alter anything. It's one of the hard things for people to do, to stop controlling and trust that this is a process which is just built on awareness and kindness. That's all. Obviously, you know, things like keeping precepts and stuff like that, doing good things, that's important too, because that helps you be kind. It's, you know, what kindness does in the world. It doesn't harm anybody. And it's always good to others, generous and forgiving and stuff, to yourself as well. A little by little, we go deeply inside. And when we go deeply inside in these jhanas, whoa, that's just the first jhana, that's blissing out. It's more bliss than you've ever felt in your whole life. It's why that, and I mention this carefully, but many people know who get into these jhanas by accident or something, they really let go, they just really go deep inside. That they often experience like a union with God. It's like you're not there. The incredible bliss and power. It's not a union with God. But it's, you know, how many people who have that framework of conceptions, those views and stuff, will experience that. So what happens next is that disappears. You go into the next layer of petals, which is the second jhana. Just beautiful stillness. The mind doesn't move at all. That's pretty fantastic. And you stay there as long as what happens. You don't choose anything. Mindfulness, kindness still working. And then that layer of petals opens up, third jhana. That layer opens up fourth jhana. These are such refined states, so beautiful. And each jhana is more powerful than the last. And eventually, when you come out, the lotus closes again, layer by layer. You come back with this wonderful experience. Which is, you know, what is this body and this mind? You've gone inside it. You've gone deeply inside of it. You're coming up with a lot of energy, a lot of clarity. The Buddha often said it's when those jhanas occur, only then do the five hindrances, you know, things like wanting and not wanting, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry and doubt, those five vanish. As do, they call the tandi and arati. Tandi is like weariness. And arati is like basically discontent. So those two also vanish. So the sign after you emerge from this is heaps of energy. You're not weary at all for days. There's so much energy, so much joy. You've got inside your lotus. And much of the things which, you know, you really were attracted to, attached to, have vanished. Not forever, but for a long time. And that gives you the opportunity, the really strong mind, to understand just what is this body, what is this mind? What is this lotus which bears your name? And how you can open it up and see what's inside. Never ever going on to the next stage. Always going in to the next stage of meditation. Insight. Seeing in. an inside of what you see now, and inside of the next thing, inside of the next thing, using compassion and awareness, strong and powerful. Thank you for listening. Now we have the questions and the complaints. And you can ask anything you want, because I already said, you try and be a lotus. Any criticism, you can pour it all over me. It'll fall off. Any praise, allow it to fall off. So, okay, Desmond.
Thank you for
there goes the talk.
I was quite transported there. By
that. Where to?
A wonderful talk, thank you. Thank you so much. There are a lot of questions here.
Okay.
Rose. Rose is asking, is there a free will, a doer, control or choice? Is there karma when you are free and complete, here and now? Is it all impermanent and illusory? Are we hallucinating when we mistakenly believe ourselves to be the separate self? Thank you.
Okay, first of all, free will. Oh, that's a big one. And of course, there isn't such a thing as free will. And that's amazing. That's one of the things which disappears at that second jhana, totally. Will is gone. You're there, you exist. You're aware, you know, you're aware, your mind is still there. There's no will left. And when you come out afterwards, you find out that, you know, you're idea of what will is very different from when you started these deep meditations. The simile, which I'm sure I've given at the Buddhist Society before, was of the tadpole. I'll say this very quickly. Tadpole cannot understand what water is. Even if it's told by its parents, mum and dad, frog, what water is. You can't know what water is if you've lived in water, born in water, been in water all your life. No more than a fish can understand the nature of water. But one day, little tadpole becomes a frog. It grows appendages like arms and legs. And one day, little frog often doesn't know what she's doing. She jumps outside of the lake. Only then does it understand this is something totally different than what it's experienced before. This is dry land. And now a little frog can understand what water is. Just the same when your will disappears in the second and deeper jhanas. Now you can understand what will is. Your own direct experience. And we always think that will is our friend. Number one, it doesn't belong to you. And mostly it's conditioned. Why do I like cups of tea? Conditioned by my parents where I grew up. Why do I tell silly jokes? My dad told silly jokes. So I play it all on him. My conditioning. So you find your will is not free at all. You become free on will, which is interesting. But your will is something very different. And that's the best way you can find out its nature. Are we the same and different, connected to other people? A lot of time we are connected. We don't have to be. You can turn off your connection to the whole world. If you go into the deep meditations, you're not connected. Connect again afterwards. But if you're always connected to the internet or to Facebook or something, you go crazy. It's great to disconnect. Rest, energize, and then come back and help in the world.
Thank you. Hi, good evening. I am so happy to chance upon this talk. I like to be enlightened when I can never truly feel, relax, or be happy. I can't pinpoint something that is unsolvable and bad. My chest always feels tight. I have nightmares quite often and can get violent at times at night. I don't know if you have a reply to that.
Oh, yes. One thing which is easy for you to do, wherever you're coming from in the world, is you get these beautiful guided meditations. So, you know, just for like half an hour, you get like a good nun like Venerable Chanda, or myself, or someone else. You can get them for free on the internet, some good things from the internet. And then you can put them, you know, your earphones in, earbuds, and listen to them. It's like, you know, you have, like, even myself, sitting right next to you, giving lots of meditation instructions, moment by moment. And you find they work. You can't sometimes even go to a place to do meditation because maybe you live too far away. Or maybe it's the wrong time of the day. You don't have the meditation class at night time when you feel really bad. So you can get these talks on an iPhone or computer, download them all for free, and then you can listen to the ones you like. And then you find you can listen to them and you find you do relax. Whenever you drive a car, you have to have a driving instructor with you when you begin, otherwise you crash too many cars. And so whoever is giving that guided meditation is like your driving instructor. And so you can do it without the instructions. You know exactly what to do. You're trained. So that's a wonderful thing to be able to do, and you find that most of those questions which you have will be answered that way, by going inside with a good instructor on the internet to tell you which way to go.
There's another one here, an interesting one. Speaking about silence, I live in Tokyo, a very busy city where it's difficult to find real silence, as there really is from a lot of noise pollution. How do you suggest finding silence in such an environment, as in cancelling outside noises? From Greece.
That is not so hard, believe it or not. But after a while, the last time I was had to do this, I was visiting Thailand, landed in Bangkok Airport, the new one, Suvarnabhumi Airport, and the lift to go to the conference was not going to go for another hour. So they said, oh, we can actually give you a nice room to rest. And I said, no, I'll meditate here. It's right in the concourse. And then people walking backwards and forwards, mobile phones going off, announcements on the PA system going off. And so, you know, I've trained myself to create what I call like a bubble. I created a bubble around myself, just an imaginary bubble. Now imagine I was inside and all this world in Bangkok, people walking backwards and forwards, shouting, loving each other, and the big kisses and meeting after such a long time, and taxis, and oh, it was a really noisy place. Inside my bubble, I was peaceful. Inside my bubble, you could, after a while, it's just that noise started to recede. It went further and further away from me. That was the perception. And after a while, it was lovely meditating, you know, for 1 hour. And you could sort of hear the noise, but it was just such a long way away. It wasn't disturbing at all. And of course, I was inside, and deep inside my lotus. So you can do that by doing a few little imaginary assistants, like a little bubble. And what is difficult sometimes if the noise suddenly changes, that disturbs you, because that's just the nature of the mind, is how it's wired to respond to sharp noises, which change abruptly. But if the ambient noise is pretty much the same, after a while you can't hear it. But don't try and get rid of it. Just go inside and it will disappear by itself. If you try to get rid of it, you're giving it attention, of course it'll always be there. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing this wonderful talk. This is from Polly Jackson. Thank you for sharing this wonderful talk. Can you tell me how long a meditation session should be for the best results?
It's very easy to answer. That's just 1 moment long. Just now. So one of the other questions is, when is the best time to meditate? And the answer is, the best time to meditate is now. The worst time to meditate is later on. And you don't even just look at the crocs. In other words, when you meditate, just one moment long, just now. And you ask sometimes people, if they're on meditation retreats, sometimes they're meditating, they really get into it, and they open their eyes, it's 3 hours, 4 hours, wow. But it doesn't feel like 3 hours or 4 hours. They haven't been asleep, they've been perfectly mindful. But very still. And then time doesn't have a meaning. I gave a talk last night where I mentioned that it's wanting which creates time. The more you want, the more time is very strong in your life. The more you don't want, same thing, you're creating time. When you're very peaceful, you don't want anything in the whole world. It's like time stops for you. Literally, that certainly happens in meditation. So don't worry about the thing called time. Just go past that. If you have appointments and you've got to do something, you can use the old trick when you start meditating, say, I have to come out at a certain time. Just tell yourself that. I usually do that 3 times. I must come out at 7 o'clock to give a talk to the Buddhist Society in Eccleston Square. I have to come out at 7 o'clock. I have to come out at 7 o'clock. When I say that, you always come out at that time. Trust your mind. It will look after you, so you don't have to worry about the length of time. Quality always is more important.
Thank you. Now, this is an interesting question. Ajahn, thank you. How is meditation similar to and different from prayer or praying?
It really depends on what type of prayer or praying you're actually doing. But a lot of times, like, prayer can be asking for something. You know, even just coarse things like wanting to win the lottery. More likely, it's just wanting to, you know, have a bit more peace in your life. Even better, to asking for the happiness and well-being of others. You're still wanting something. And sometimes, in meditation, we put aside that wanting for a while to strengthen our mind, and then we can do the service for others at a later time. We need to energize ourselves, first of all. If you're going to be someone who gives, you have to have something to give, first of all. And too many people, they love to give, but they've got nothing inside themselves of great value to share with others. So little by little, instead of action, but there are other types of prayer where, you know, people do have a silent prayer. They try and get closer to this sort of kindness and mindfulness. But just putting it in that way, the kindness and mindfulness, simile of the lotus, it is not asking for anything, not requesting favors from anybody, no supreme beings, but just using the very nature of your own body and mind and reality to experience some wonderful, deep, peaceful states. And quite frankly, that I've had people come on some of the retreats. Many years ago, I had this devout Muslim came on one of my retreats. And I think from Indonesia, she wore a hijab all the way to the retreat. And as soon as she got into the retreat, she took the hijab off, the veil off. And you know, she had a wonderful time. She said, I don't know, what's the problem? You know, why can't Muslims do this? I don't know. But anyway, she had a wonderful time. So prayer, meditation, what does it actually really mean? Learning how to be peaceful, to be still, to be kind. No religion can own that. Okay.
Thank you. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what should a lotus do when with every day's rising sun, the lotus rises in a field surrounded by thorns?
Be kind to those thorns. And those thorns will probably, like everything else, the poor little lotus goes inside itself. It gets so powerful, so beautiful, so fragrant, that even those thorns, they start to, even the sharp edges start to become soft and beautiful. Which is more powerful? The sharp anger or the beautiful kindness and love? Remember a Buddha. You don't remember just people who did lots and lots of harm in our world. As much as we remember someone who is kind and compassionate like a Buddha. So which is more powerful? Kindness, wisdom, peace, or just that aggressive harshness of a thorn? Who knows? Then also, the thorn may be like that fellow which I misjudged, maybe a bit sharp on the outside. But what's inside that thorn? Maybe the thorn could open itself up and see its beautiful flowery nature. But anyway, if you wake up in the morning surrounded by thorns, you know, you should change your bedroom. Sleep inside or something. At least you can have some space by yourself. Okay.
Thanks for your wonderful talk, Ajahn Brown. What's your thought of silent meditation and guided meditation? Which do you recommend?
If you can do silent meditation, of course that's superior. But, you know, sometimes people can't do the silent meditation. They may not be hearing somebody speak, but inside their head, they're speaking to themselves all the time. This is interesting, just on the side, I never mention this. I very rarely mention this, but you get to a certain stage in meditation. Your mind is very powerful, it's clear. And there's some of the best meditation talks I've ever given were to myself at this particular stage of meditation. Like I was thinking, but things really clearly. But you're missing the point here. Even in the suttas, the Buddha said this is called the lingering obstacle before you get into samadhi. The lingering obstacle is called Dhamma Vitakka, thinking about the Dhamma. And the Buddha said it's an obstacle. So you're thinking about the Dhamma, you're not seeing the Dhamma. So it's wonderful to be able to have a silent mind. But many people will waste a lot of time trying to get that silence by themselves. They're not used to it. So it's great having teachers. And it's very hard to get a teacher to go to your house and teach in the old days. But now you've got internet. You can get the guided meditation. So do the guided meditation first. And every now and again, try to do it by yourself. See if you've learned the lesson yet. If you can get into a nice deep meditation, you don't need the guided meditation. It's fine. That's superior.
Here's another question. I assume this refers to the Abhidharma. This is, what do you think about the method of labeling things that arise?
Labeling, number one, the labeling is inaccurate. You know, you're just giving it sort of a sort of name. But, you know, is that really accurate? It's also really disturbing because things arise so fast. So giving it a label, sometimes you give it another label. If you're going to give things label, try the same label. Right? This is one type of meditation. It's going to take a minute or two. Just listen to the reaction in your mind when I give a label. Peace. 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 I'd love to carry on, but after a while you can actually feel the peace. The label doesn't describe or capture something. The label creates things. So I was creating some peace in your mind just by saying a word. Your mind would automatically go there. And after a while, as I do this little meditation saying peace a few times, the gap between the labels gets longer and longer. You don't need the label anymore. You have the peace. What is more real, the label or the experience? Okay. Next question?
Yes. I found it challenging when my mind is so irritated that it doesn't want to meditate and to calm. I don't mean to control it, but I feel I'm still missing something. How to handle it? Can you explain a bit more how to apply kindness in such a situation?
Yeah. Kindness shouldn't be trying to get rid of an irritating mind. It's loving your irritating mind. Say, irritating mind, the door of my heart is open to you as well. Not just the nice people, but all people. Even irritating things. And the story which explains that is one of my favorite ones, which is actually in the suttas, in the Yakasamyutta, I think. And it was about what we call the anger-eating monster. And the Buddha described it like this empress was at the Buddhist society in Ekusun Square going to a talk anonymously. And after the great talk, she went back to her palace and she found a big monster had gone into the palace while she was away. And the monster was so frightening, so ugly and so smelly that it managed to go right into the throne room and sit on the empress's chair, the throne. And then all of the guards and security came out, get out of here, this is not your place, get out. And every unkind word, unkind deed or unkind thought even, the monster grew bigger and more frightening and more smelly. And when the empress came back, the monster was huge and was so aggressive and was so stinky that even, as I say, the maggots which was crawling on the monster's skin, even they vomited. They threw up too. They could take the smell. But the empress, because she'd just been to the Buddhist society, she knew exactly what to do. She said to this monster, "Monster, welcome. How come you waited so much time before popping in to see me? Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet?" And that was sincere, kind words. So it's when we open the door of our heart to everybody, may all beings be happy and well, even stinky monsters. And because it was sincere, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less violent. And all the people in the palace realized their mistake. So they started giving this monster so much kindness. And every act of kindness, thought of kindness, the monster grew smaller. And soon the monster was back to the size when it first came in, but they kept on with the kindness until the monster soon grew so small. One more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. It's adapted from a story from the Buddha called the anger-eating monster. It feeds on anger, it gets worse. So if you get irritated, don't give irritation or anger. Say, thank you. Body, what do you want? Do you want a cup of tea or do you want to sort of go for a walk? Do you want to just lay down and have a sleep? Watch a movie? What do you want? Body, mind. Whatever the body answers, give it to it. Be kind. And then your mind doesn't get irritated. You do that after a while and you ask the body, what do you want now? And the body and mind says, actually, I'd like to meditate. Okay, let's meditate together. So you don't never control your mind. It's your best friend. So you work together. And sometimes you do what your best friend wants to do. And then your best friend wants to do what you want to do. That's the way you work with your mind, with kindness, compassion, with friendliness. It's not your slave. Okay, let's have another question.
This looks like the last question here. I've reached the nimitta stage and have been there for a year or so, but don't seem to be able to progress to the jhanas. What may I be doing wrong?
That's an easy one. It's because you want to progress. You don't progress, you ingress. So stay with the nimittas. Amazing. That's good enough. No, I want more. That's the problem. So I say, stay with the nimittas. They're beautiful. Just enjoy them. And if you don't want anything more, if you're totally content with these powerful nimittas, then the jhanas happen.
There's another question. It's two more, actually. Is there optimal duration for meditation, like 15 minutes from deep?
No, there's no optimal. Just however long it takes. What's the optimal time to eat? It depends how hungry you are. Is there no optimal time? Just don't even think of a time. Just see if you can, when you meditate, just get out of that sort of idea of wanting to get things or attainments or time. Be free of those things. And okay, this, another question?
This is the very last one that I can see here, unless I've missed some. Is it time we recognize silence as a global language of truth?
Great, yes. Imagine just the United Nations. People were really, truly sitting silently. Not just with their mouths closed, with their minds at peace, but with their eyes open, looking at one another. And seeing if they can see things which are valuable in one another, to see different ways of looking at things. Different ways of respecting one another. Because silence, you can see more truth, and it stops these old conditioned ways of how we're told to look and to think. And in the silence, where does that conditioning, it stopped, it's paused. It allows you to reset all the parameters of your perception. So you can see people you're working with, it's a matter sort of what gender, what sort of age, what race, religion, what sort of healthy, deformed or whatever, not deformed, different, helps us actually appreciate much more. It's in silence we learn. In thinking, it's just old stuff going round and round and round the same direction. In silence we can see things anew. Things we've never seen before. So silence is beautiful. I think it's a wonderful language. Not the only language, but a language we've often forgotten.
I don't know if you have time for one last one.
Yeah, go for it.
Go for it. Yeah, thank you for your wonderful talk. Thoroughly enjoyed it. My question is, when we meditate, we send blessings to our loved ones, friends, and relatives. In our mind, is it still silence meditation, as our mind is actually busy?
And then exactly. So don't send your best wishes until the end of the meditation. Now, you can't give a donation to the Buddhist Society in Eccleston Square if you haven't made any money in the bank yet. So finish work and make the money. And once you've got the money, then you can give donations. Get the peace, get the joy first, and only at the end of the meditation. Share all the benefits, the happiness, the joy of the great stuff you've made to all beings.
I think that's a beautiful point to end on. Really do. You've given us so much to think about, to reflect on, and to practice. And so thank you very, very, very much indeed. And I really hope we can see you again. We all wish you a very happy festivities.
Christmas, yeah, call it Christmas, or Buddhamas, as Ajahn Chah used to call it. So happy Buddhamas to you all. And may you all be in good health and happiness and joy. Yeah. And I'm sure I'll see you again soon.
Good. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.